From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. We're thrilled to bring you the third and final conversation in our Season 10 series, Our Bodies in Space. In today's interview, we'll be talking about perception, the maps created by our brains, and the influence of physical space on our well-being. My guest today is Ana Monpietro, an enthusiastic architect who believes in innovation through built space. She graduated from the CEU School of Architecture in Spain in 2014 and completed her architecture training at Aalto University in Finland. There, she worked on designing learning environments and started her research on neuroarchitecture. From 2014 to 2016, she did her online training in neuroscience and perception at Duke University, while working as an interdisciplinary teacher at Colgate University in New York State. These days, Ana combines her research, entitled The Neurological Impacts of Built Space and Its Relationship with Human Behavior, with her job as a high school teacher. She truly believes that the foundational purpose of architecture is to ensure the emotional health of those who dwell within. Welcome, Ana. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here and to see you. We haven't seen each other for many years, so it's a treat to see you. Let's start with your personal story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your childhood and how you came to be interested in architecture?
Okay, so thank you for having me here again. I'm very happy to share a piece of my story and how I came up being an architect, because it was actually kind of a surprise, even for myself. At the very beginning, when I had to decide what to study, I was very committed to designing toys for kids. So, because along my childhood, I was very into fine arts. I actually come from a family of pharmacists. So, I never thought of being an architect. Fine arts was always something we would talk about at home. We would go to museums, visit exhibitions, go into the opera. I even was a ballet dancer for 14 years.
So, ballet, tell us more about that.
Yeah, I was a very active girl, like I loved movement. So my parents always tried to take me to as many activities as possible. Mm-hmm. And when I was actually 2 years old, I discovered that I loved dancing. Mm-hmm. So they took me to a small ballet school that was there in Cuenca, in the town I grew up. Mm-hmm. And ever since I started going there, I have been like in touch and completely in love with dancing.
Mm. And did you study other styles as well, or just ballet?
Yes, I also studied flamenco and sevillanas, mm-hmm. and even traditional, there is a traditional dance called bolero. Mm-hmm. So every new activity that was, you know, like they were suggestion, I will join in and say, yeah, definitely, let me try that, you know.
You know, now that I'm a parent, I'm imagining this 2-year-old and then 6-year-old and then 8-year-old saying, I want to do this class, I want to do that class. I'm sure you were
exactly.
involved in everything.
Exactly.
So how did, you were telling us a little bit about, bit by bit, how you came to architecture. So how did dance play a role in that?
Oh, I think that it woke up a side of myself that was very connected to emotions, you know, like I would feel the space and I would feel these signs in a different way. I like the music, you know, I was feeling connected to some spaces, but not to some other spaces. Mm-hmm. I really liked spending time outdoors. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, somehow woke up like my artist, the artist I had in me. Mm-hmm. Because architecture is a very artisty degree. Mm-hmm. And when I had to decide what to study, I told my parents that I just wanted to design toys. But they were like, yeah, but you know, there is not such a degree like toy designing by that mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm.
Is there now?
There is now. You can actually study product design.
Oh, product design, of course.
So that would be it, you know. Okay. If yeah, I think product design would fit nowadays, mm-hmm. but it didn't exist by that time.
Okay.
So we had to look for other interests that I mm-hmm. had. Mm-hmm. Like, what else do you like? And I really liked psychology as well and maths. Mm-hmm. And of course, drawing and doing all sorts of, you know, handcraft things.
Yeah.
So it was my parents who suggested architecture. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that told me, why don't you try architecture? Mm-hmm. And I have to say that I had no idea what an architect was doing other yeah. than building, you know? Mm-hmm. So I felt at the very beginning, I felt like I don't want to do an engineering degree. Mm-hmm. It was like a lot of maths and so on. But as I was studying, I was discovering that architecture had nothing to do with building. It was a way that professionals like architects had to connect with users, with other people through the design of space.
Mm-hmm. So you began to see it as more of an art than
exactly,
a science.
Exactly. And I have to say that by when I was in the third, fourth year of my degree, I fell completely in love with the degree itself, with everything we were doing, because I had a different perspective.
Yeah. It sounds like your eyes were really opened by that experience. Now, from what I understand, you did end up studying architecture in Spain, more specifically in Madrid. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, because that was the closest town from Cuenca where I could study it.
Okay.
And I have some relatives there as well. So it made it easier to start studying. So I started in Madrid, yeah.
And I also have to say it's interesting because I've lived in Spain long enough when I, you know, as an American who's lived in Spain for 18 years, almost 19 years, I hear you say, well, it was close to home. I had family there. And that is so Spanish. That is so Spanish. And you, we'll get to this later, but you lived and worked in the United States. And I think you also would recognize that that's more Spanish than American. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In America, you can, I don't know, you're from California and then you go and study in New York State. And it's like, oh my God, so far away. Yeah,
exactly. But people almost look for opportunities to be far away from their family in the
US. Here we look for opportunities to stay as close as possible.
Exactly. So you finished your undergraduate degree in Madrid, mm-hmm. and then you went to continue your studies in Finland. Is that right?
Kind of, actually. So I finished these studies in Finland, but you know, architecture finishes with what's called like a final project somehow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I finished, like I did like the first 4 years of my degree in Madrid, and then I switched school and I moved to Finland, and I did the last year, like the last credits I had to fulfill to have like all the credits that are required to be an architect.
Okay.
But then I submitted this project that you have to do. I submitted it in Spain.
Okay.
So technically, I'm an architect through the Spanish university.
Okay.
But I finished this last year of learning. I did it in Finland.
Okay. Well, I'm very interested in asking you about your impressions of the cultural similarities and differences between, you know, a Southern European country, mm-hmm. which is Spain, your home country, and a Northern European country, which is Finland. What were the similarities and differences culturally when it comes to life in general, and also the educational systems, because you were there as a student?
Exactly. I have to say that my experience in Finland was life-changing. It changed me completely. I was meant to be there for 1 year, and I ended up being there 3 years. Because I told you, I submitted my final degree project in Madrid, but I just submitted it. I actually did it while I was in Finland.
Okay.
So there are no similarities. I mean, the similarity would be that we're humans, both Finnish people and Spanish people are humans. Yeah. And yeah, we've got feelings and we like being with each other. There is love among people, but everything else is completely different. The way people socialize, for example, you know, like at school, we had to do projects as well. And we were designing a library. And I remember one time there was this classmate of mine in Finland, and he would say, well, I have designed this socializing spots so people can socialize here, here and there. And I couldn't understand that as a Spanish person, you know. I was like,
because it was from a Finnish perspective, how Finnish people socialize.
I was like, but people socialize everywhere, you know, like that's what space is for. And he was like, oh, no, people don't socialize. And I came to understand. And then I was observing, you know, I was like, he was right. Actually, they're like in their own bubbles, you know, and that's I found it really beautiful because it's respect. They're very respectful to each other. And when they want to be close to someone, they're close to someone. But most of the time, I would say all the time, they're respecting everyone's atmosphere somehow.
Wow. You know, that I don't want to go too far down this path, but it really makes me think about COVID.
Oh, okay.
You know, the spread of COVID, because in Spain, the numbers are just, you know, we're recording this on October 26th, we'll air in a couple of weeks. But as of today's date, the numbers are just really rising at a really alarming rate. And I think that's true throughout Europe, but it's also true that depending on the country, the rate of rise is very different. And I think it's fair to say that in the north of Europe, the rate is not as alarming. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hearing you say words like bubbles and space and respecting each other's personal space, it's like, oh, that sounds like a good way to mitigate the spread of COVID.
Exactly. I was actually thinking when this social distance rule started to be applied or suggested, at least here in Spain, I couldn't help it. I had to think of Finland, and I was like, well, there, the social distance belongs to the culture somehow. You know?
Yeah, it's a given.
Yeah. And I have to say that after living there for 3 years, I got really used to it. And then I felt weird when I was visiting my family in Spain. I would come here and I would think, why is everybody shouting so much, you know? And why are they so close to me? Like, I don't know you, you know? And
yeah, everyone's kissing
me.
Yeah,
like, hey.
up in my face.
It's fine. I know you love me. You don't have to kiss me all the time. So somehow it had an impact on my personality, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
But you know what I found very interesting is that the way their personality is very attached to their environment, to the place they live, to the seasons. Because, you know, the society, if we speak in a general term, in Finland, they have a behavior, like a summer behavior and a winter behavior.
Wow.
And of course, the weather is, it doesn't let you do many things in the winter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the summer, sun is shining almost 24/7. So
yeah,
picnic and sauna and party and everyone wants to dance and, you know, so all sorts of festivals and music and joy, and that's the summer in Finland. And in winter, it's time to be home. It's time for silence. I always say that in Finland was the first time I could hear snowing.
That's how quiet it is.
It actually happened, you know, like I was at home and it was snowing a lot and I was very concentrated and I was alone and I was looking through the window and I could see the snow falling and how the flakes were, you know, falling on top of each other. And I could actually see the snowflakes and I was like, wow, this is crazy. And I could hear it. I could feel it, you know? It was like,
I love it. I wish we could spend the whole time talking about Finland. We're going to have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to hear more from architect Anna Monbiedro. Back in a second. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anna Monbiedro, an architect whose research focuses on the neurological impacts of built space. So before the break, we were talking about your 3 years in Finland. And before we move on to talk about some of the more technical aspects of your research and your career, I just wanted to ask you about the time you spent in Finland working on the design of learning environments. What can you share with us about the importance of built space when it comes to education?
I'm happy you're making me this question, Kate, because when we were, and I say we, because I was working with a team, of course, I wasn't designing educational environments on my own. So when we were talking about the role of education in Finland, as a joke, we used to say that it was like a religion, you know, to Finnish people, that education is a religion there, because it's the core of the society. It's so important. Mm. And actually what we were doing was that we were visiting schools and we were talking to teachers so we could get to know the educational system, how it works. And it's so important because in Finland, since it's got such a low population, both parents always have had to work. So kids had to spend a lot of time at schools since they're very, very little. So people working in the schools, in the päiväkoti or in the kindergartens, had to be very well prepared. And that's why you usually find nurses, psychologists, not only teachers, but many professionals working with the kids. And not only the people who work with the kids are well prepared, but also the spaces. I was telling you before about this respectful behavior that is very characteristic. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the learning environments, like the schools and kindergartens, they also have this respectful behavior towards the users. And the materials and the geometry and the way they're distributed helps having this behavior.
So it's kind of like a system, right? Like the building, the architecture of the built space, the people who populate that building, the activities that they're carrying out in the building, they all work together in a system.
Exactly.
Is that what you're
That's
saying?
Exactly what I'm saying. And actually the building helps, you know, like supports the activities. So, for example, we once went to a kindergarten and we were just observing how, you know, the activities they were doing. And there was this three-year-old kid. And without saying anything, he went to where the hangers were. And there was this, like, fluorescent, what was it called? A vest. Yeah, a vest. Bright vest, because it was winter, so there was snow outside. So he just put on the vest, and on his own, I'm talking about a three-year-old, on his own went outside playing with the snow all by himself. He didn't even told the teacher, you know, he didn't tell the teacher, I'm gonna go outside and play. And the teacher said, yeah, good, it's okay, Jonas. No, he just But since it's all glass windows, the teacher at all times could see the movements of the kids.
Okay, both inside and outside.
And there are some windows that the teachers can see, but the kids can't. So they're being observed, but they don't know.
Yeah, that's a great example. It's a great example of how, you know, a society needs, they need a series of specific things from their buildings. So ideally, they build their buildings to support those needs and afford them what they need. As you know, this interview is part of a series called Our Bodies in Space. And I'm so interested in space, and that's what you deal in. That's what an architect deals in, and we will get back to that. But I would like to turn now to the body, to the human body. So let's talk a little bit about, or if you could, you're the expert, talk a little bit about perception and how our bodies and our brains perceive the physical space around us.
Okay, so I was just talking about kids, right? And how the way they perceive the space is different from the way we as adults perceive the space, or the way my grandfather, who is 96 years old, perceives the space. And that's because our bodies are different, okay? So we get to understand the space we dwell through our body. At the very beginning, when we're kids, our brains are not mature enough. So we have to do testing, we have to understand gravity, we have to understand textures and weights and so on. And little by little, we create maps in our brain about the information that we've got around us. When we're adults, when our brains are mature enough, we are familiar with the environment, so we can navigate through space. We know where things are. We know left and right and up and down and so on. And as we get older, these perception abilities, they change as well. Somehow they get a bit worse. You know, it can happen due to dementia. We can get lost in space, or we can get lost in time, or we can even get lost in our own bodies. So as far as it is known at the moment, thanks to a research done by Penfield, who was a neurosurgeon from the United States. So he discovered that we have a so-called, well, he named it, homunculus, which is a map of our body in our brain. So we've got in the parietal lobe, which is on the top of our head, we've got exactly an area in which our hand is depicted, our arm, our back, our tongue. Okay, and we've got two different areas: a sensitive one and a motor one. So one area for movement, and another area for sensing.
Ah, okay. These are kind of sides of the same coin. Two areas of the same map.
Exactly. We can move our fingers, and we can feel our fingers.
Okay.
And through through the sensitive area of our fingers, we can recognize textures and surfaces.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's so interesting. You know, it's, you know, when you go on a trip, or, you know, you go to visit someone, or you go to a hotel, or you go on safari. So every single thing is new. You know, there's a time change and all the animals are exotic. I would imagine. I've never been on safari. But there's that feeling when you travel that is so different from when you're at home. You know, you're at home in your pajamas with the remote control in your hand that feels so, you know, familiar, like you know where all the buttons are without even looking. Is that feeling when you travel, is the reason that you have that feeling explained by what you have just explained to us, that map in your brain can't account for that new environment and your body in that new environment.
Exactly. The brain in that case, like when you're traveling or when you're experiencing something new, you're receiving new stimuli. So mm-hmm. somehow your brain is, I call it, you have a happy brain because you're feeding your brain with new information.
Yeah. And yeah. So it's not bored.
Exactly. It's not bored. It's actually wiring out. It's really good to travel and to have new experiences because that's how we learn. And that's how the brain wires together.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was just going to say, is that a good thing? Because, you know, it's comforting. Familiarity is comforting. You know, it's nice to be at home in your comfy clothes and, you know, you can walk to the bathroom in the night without bumping into anything because you know where everything is. And yet, if we never encourage ourselves to get out of that, we don't grow.
Exactly. And I always say that we need to have health and health, you know, a bit of mm-hmm. comfort and familiarity and feeling like everything you're doing is known, but getting new stimuli, it's also very tiring. You can also see that baby is like my own kid who's 15 months at the moment. Mm-hmm. He's playing with some new textures and objects and he gets really tired and he actually even needs to sleep because there was so much new information coming from the outside to his nervous system, yeah. You know?
Yeah, and that explains those naps that kids take, you know, when they're your son's age. They just, I mean, they go, and then they pass out for hours. They just can't anymore.
Exactly.
You know, you mentioned three key stages in a person's life, but there was one you didn't mention, and it happens to be the stage that my son is in. Your son is 15 months. My son just turned 13. And you would not believe how tall he is all of a sudden. And so the stage I'm referring to is adolescence. And the body undergoes really, really huge, surprising, amazing changes during this period in a human being's life. What's the story with this map that you've described? I think you said it was called the homunculus.
Homunculus, exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. What happens with the map during adolescence?
So thanks to brain plasticity, the brain changes. And as mm-hmm. our body changes, the brain changes as well. And it's like someone who plays piano has the fingers way more sensitive, you know, than someone who doesn't. And what happens mm-hmm. with kids like your son who grow up very fast is that they can get all of a sudden very clumsy, you know, because they are growing faster than the brain is rewiring everything. The brain is getting mm-hmm. used to it.
So the map has to sort of catch up.
Exactly. Yeah. Has to get used to it. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, myself, I'm not pregnant and I'm 31 weeks and little by little, my belly is growing, but now all of a sudden it's going to grow very fast and probably my map won't get used to it fast enough. So I will start, you know, hitting things at home and oops, sorry, you know, and that's, that's the reason behind it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Man. Brains.
Yeah, and
did you know that you would be learning about brains when you decided to study architecture?
Yeah, I the thing is that that's a funny thing, but I had so many questions and the only answers were given by how the brain works. So I ended up studying neuroscience as well. Like, okay, I need to study that. Yeah.
You never know. You never know where things are going to lead mm-hmm. you. Let's take another short break. And we will be right back to continue our conversation with architect Ana Monbiedro. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you visit our new website at thelistenpodcast.com, you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. I'm also hoping you'll subscribe to our podcast. When you sign up and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Ana Monbiedro about her career as an architect. Ana, before we get back to some more questions, could you take a moment to let our listeners know how and where they could find you?
Absolutely. I have a website where I have some of the papers I've published and some of the projects I've been working, both on architecture and education. And it's anamombiedro.com, anamombiedro.com. And I'm a very active user in Twitter. So if they want to give me a shout through this social media, I'll be happy to share any extra information they're curious about. And my Twitter user is AnukiNuk, which is A-N-U-K-I-N-U-K. I also have an Instagram account, okay, but I'm not using it much. But if it's my name and my surname, so they can look for me as well.
Okay, so it's just Ana Monbiedro if they go to Instagram. But sounds like people have more luck with Twitter or your website. And we will have all that information on our website, so people can look that information up there. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so just going back to an earlier comment in our conversation, you were talking about how our brains do this amazing job of keeping track of our bodies as they move through space. But let's talk about where architecture comes into the picture. How do our brains keep track of the space itself?
Well, there is actually a discipline that is called wayfinding that is starting to be known nowadays, in which, unfortunately, it's understood as a way to put signals on the walls, you know, but the wayfinding is more than that. It's the wayfinding understands how we navigate through space, okay? And we use stimuli from the environment to know where we are in every moment. And since once we know where we are, we can know where we want to go and how we can come back. So we can build paths, you know, mental paths.
And when you say stimuli, are you talking about things that we're all familiar with? Like, for example, if there's an echo or what kind of lighting there is, if it's dark, if it's light, if there's a strobe light? Or are you talking about specific stimuli that are developed for
wayfinding? When I talk about stimuli, I refer to all kinds of information that gets to our body. So for example,
any kind of information.
Because for example, a very powerful building tool for architecture is light. And you may think, but it's not a construction material. Well, maybe you can't touch it, but when you don't see a place in your perception, it doesn't exist. You know, if you don't perceive it, it's not there. So light is a very intelligent way of building space, but it's very difficult as well, because you know it's a construction tool that is not understood as one, but it is there. I think it's interesting to understand that our body don't pick up like random stimuli, but we take the whole atmosphere. So for example, when we enter to a cathedral, the echo, the smell, even if we have our eyes closed, we know we're in a cathedral. Okay?
Yeah.
So those kind of parameters, you know, this this stimuli, that's what I take when I have to design a space. I think, okay, what do I want my user to feel, and how are they going to recognize they're in a movie theater because it smells like popcorn, because they can listen to other movies and maybe some people shouting. Or so we play around with perception when we have to design a space.
Yeah, it's interesting. These are things that I've never considered. I mean, it's fascinating to me, even though it has very little to do with the world that I live in and that sort of the information that I find myself reading or studying. And yet it's something that affects all of us. The question that comes to me hearing you speak is, where am I? You know, so we all go, well, nowadays, unfortunately, less and less, where most of us are at home or at work. But, you know, in the world of 7 or 8 months ago, and hopefully the world of the not too distant future, we're in many different spaces all day long, all year long. And somehow we know where we are. You know, you're in your car. You're at the supermarket, you're at a concert, you're having coffee with a friend. And the information that you need to answer that question, mm-hmm. where am I, is all provided by what you've just described. It's the light, it's the temperature, it's the ambient sounds. Mm-hmm. I want to go back because we are going to have to wrap up our conversation soon, but I really want to spend some time on this final question, which goes back to... when I introduced you, I referenced the fact that you are currently teaching in a public high school in...
Exactly.
Mallorca?
Yeah, yes, in Mallorca.
Is that where you live? Okay. So in Mallorca, I'm really curious about the architecture mm-hmm. of the high school where you have worked. And I'd love to hear some of your impressions about what works in that building, what doesn't work in that building, and what you as a professional would change ideally if you had an unlimited budget and support for doing so. What would you do to improve the buildings where our children spend so much of their time?
Okay, I'm going to start with improvements because I think that's the most urgent thing. And and at the same time, this is something I really like from the building I teach in, and it's that there is a lot mm-hmm. of nature. We have loads of trees. Mm. The only thing that I'm missing is some water, like a small pond or fountains. Usually you don't find sources of water in schools because they tend to say, people tend to say, they.
You know, they. The people who are paying
people
to build the schools.
Who rule the schools tend to say that then the kids misbehave and then they get dirty and so on. Okay, but water is a source of life. So having, for example, having trees and having bushes and having grass and having all this brings animals and brings life to the school. So the school or the learning space has to be somewhere where your body feels comfortable. We are not, I mean, mm-hmm. even though we live in urban areas, we come from human beings that during thousands and thousands of years have lived outdoors. So we have a strong connection with natural materials like wood, like water, okay? Being in touch with the sky. So all mm-hmm. of that enhances our wiring, our nervous system. It helps learning somehow. So mm-hmm. that's something I really like from the building I work in. That, for instance, I can go and teach at the playground one day. If it's sunny, we've got some blackboards and we can have a lesson outdoors. And I do it. And kids love it. And it's funny because I'm one of the very few teachers who regularly does it. And he always gets so happy. And they actually remember better those lessons than the ones we do indoors. Because their bodies, their brains are happy. So it's a teaching tool. I always say that space is a teaching tool. Okay. That's something I think that all schools should improve. Like the presence of nature. Mm-hmm. Then also something very positive of the building I work in is that it's very well organized. So kids can very easily build mind maps of the space. They know exactly where to go and they don't get lost. This can seem like, how are they going to get lost? Well, you would be surprised by the amount of schools that are not well designed, that the space is not well lit, so you cannot see properly, and it's difficult to navigate through the space. Also, there are huge windows on both sides of the classrooms. So they're connected. All the classrooms are connected to the outside and connected to the central corridor where all their students walk through. So there, it's very easy to clean the air nowadays, that it's so important to have clean air. And
you mean because you can easily create a cross current just by opening one outside window and one inside window?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
The density of the air is different depending on the temperature of the air. So the hot air always goes out or in depending on the temperature.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So it's very easy to ventilate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any thought that you would care to leave us with? You know, we've talked quite a bit about schools and, you know, designing learning environments. You've had quite a bit of experience in this field. What about something that applies to all of us, which is our homes? Is there a piece of advice that you could leave us with as far as something that, you know, kind of a little, a minor change, an easy change, not too expensive, that we could all bring into our homes to make our home environments more comfortable, more enjoyable and easy to be in?
So I could share with you and our listeners two pieces of advice. The first one is that built space or our homes also have the power to take care of us. I mean, they can help us healing. So they can work with us in a way. And then the second one is that what we perceive is what we think. So if we want to have positive thoughts and if we want to feel comfortable, we have to take care of our surroundings and display information that gives us these positive feelings. So having the house clean and organized and with nice memories in front of us will, you know, bright us up in a way.
Yeah, it's cheerful. It's positive.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Of course, we could go into detail and talk about distribution of space and the use of color. But so try not to be too aggressive or try not to combine too many different materials and textures because then you overstimulate yourself.
Well, Anna, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure learning more about your work, and I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you, Kate, for having me here today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This concludes our Season 10 series, Our Bodies in Space. Many thanks to Jen Pendleton, Lauren Lovett, and Anna Monpiedro for their generous contributions. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the ancient convent of San Pablo was built by the Dominican order in the 16th century. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out our full archive at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.